The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to From the Rookery End, a podcast about Watford FC brought to you by The Athletic. It's Friday night. We love a Friday night. We love a Friday night where Watford win. And they just about did. 2-1 at home against Derby County. Or should I say, because you have to say his name every time you now mention the team, it's Wayne Rooney's Derby County, as Sky kept going on about. I've been watching at home. Jason's with me. You watching at home, Jason?
I was watching at home indeed.
And Michael, where were you watching?
I'm at Vicarage Road and I'm actually as close to being from the Rookery End as is possible. I'm in the last row of the Sir Elton John stand over on the left-hand side towards the Rookery, shielding from what has been a very blustery wind. So yeah, very nearly from the Rookery End.
I've got a question. Is it wind or have you borrowed Adam's sound effects machine from Tuesday night?
Well, let the listeners decide.
Well, the authenticity is quite hard to tell sometimes. So, Mark, you're at the game. We said, and you showed us last, and heard, showed us orally last week. Yeah, it's a different experience for you. What was it like, though, for you throughout that game, especially compared to the last two? It was another win, and we had three in the trot. How are you feeling in that game?
At the end, exceptionally nervous. It was.
Let's start at the beginning. How is the beginning? First half.
But yeah, well, it was an interesting game, and very quickly Watford found themselves sort of back to winning ways. It felt like, you know, two goals in very, very quick succession, and it felt a little bit like, you know, normal service resumed. You know, the Watford had a bit of a swagger, a bit of a saunter about them. Derby looked a bit shell shocked, and yeah, it felt very, very positive. It felt like a continuation of a theme for a little bit there, which I have to say was rather enjoyable, as I alluded to there. That didn't last long, and it was a good win, but it was, and there was, I think, all the positive things that we've seen in the last week were there again. But I think there's still the overarching sort of feeling is there's still work to do, and this is still very much a work in progress. But hugely positive, and the fact that they're able to take the game away from Derby in those couple of minutes just shows what this Watford side can do. So absolutely more positives than negatives for me.
Yeah, I mean, I do look at this and say, hey, amazing, 9 points, 7 days. And then also look at it the same way and say, well, maybe that's in fact three games in a week and not a lot of change might be those reasons why we weren't quite as rampant as we were against Bristol City. But, you know, again, Bristol City were a particularly bad team, and Derby weren't as bad as them. Jason, you know, the tactics, you know, we saw again the thing that we're all coming to love as Watford fans, the 4-3-3. The front six are exactly the same, and only the one change in the defence. Did you see any development on that? Because, you know, in the last podcast, you talked about how the midfield three seemed to be a bit more organised, a bit more defined in how they played. What did you notice today in terms of from that Bristol City to that Preston and now against Derby, the tactics that Munoz is putting out there?
I'm not sure in terms of changes that perhaps we went into the game with, but I think Derby proved a different challenge today. They pretty much matched us up. They played a 4-3-3, but it looked like they had a sort of a couple of men sitting deeper, so it almost matched. So almost sort of man-marking our midfielders. They were happy to let our centre-backs have the ball as well. Certainly at 0-0, they didn't seem to want to press. So it was very congested. So it meant we had to try and find gaps, we had to find the space, we had to try and overload in certain positions. And I thought we did that pretty well, particularly the way the full-backs attacked tonight, I thought worked really well. Obviously, we seem to focus our attack down the right-hand side with Ismaïla Sarr and Kiko Femenia. I thought Kiko did a really good job of sort of underlapping, if that makes sense. So Sarr was sort of sticking pretty wide, and Femenia would sort of play a 1-2 and sort of drive inside and try and find space where Sarr was driving men out wide. Slightly different, I think, on the left. Ken seemed to drift inside a bit more, leaving space for Messina to go on the outside and provide an overlap. So we would work in that quite well. And then also, I thought the two advanced midfielders, they played a good game because, one, they had to try and find space because they had these sort of two central midfielders sitting on them. what they did to support the guys out wide is that they were actually happy to play quite wide. At times, they were the widest man. So if Ken or at times if Ismaila was sort of tucking in, they were looking to go wide and provide width, which twofold gives us the overload, but then also gets them away or drags the central midfield out of position to try and create space for someone else to move into. And again, it was certainly the first goal came from Ismaila Sarr getting behind thanks to a good ball from Kiko, where he has occupied that sort of inside back role, for want of a better description, to then sort of play the ball through.
The Kiko and Sarr show was back in sort of full effect for Tuff, certainly in the first half there, and they were sort of finding each other at will, and they were starting to find again, not quite telepathic, but that just understanding where they were going to be, knowing that either of them have got the pace to run onto a pass from one or the other. And what I've noticed, chaps, Jace, I don't know if you think that this might be a tactic, but when we're getting the ball out wide, I think it's something that we've said we've struggled with throughout the season, is not really knowing what to do with it, how to best make use of the ball in the final third. It looks like we're drilling these balls in, certainly from Ismaila Sarr. I noticed it in midweek and it happened again today. He's really sort of hitting those balls in hard instead of trying to pick a man. He's sort of just getting it in there and asking questions of the defenders and hoping something happens. Is that something you picked up on as well, Jace?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that the fact that we're getting bodies in the box as well probably adds to that. If you've got a packed box, then even if you don't get the touch, what might happen is that the ball will ping off a defender and go into the back of the net. Hey, we might see that happen at Vicarage Road one sometime.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely more for him to hit in the box. He isn't, you know, he's not trying to pick one person out because that's all he could do. You know, there are definitely many men running in there and on across the whole pitch. It's amazing.
I don't think they're not just random ones either as well. So going back to that goal and a couple of the goals, I think, against Bristol City, that we do seem to have men. So we've got guys running into the box, sort of leading the line, but there does seem to be someone hanging back as well, maybe around the penalty spot. And when Sarr gets to the byline, he's not sort of hitting it into a corridor of uncertainty, so to speak. He is sort of pulling it back to that area to try and find either a midfielder or someone sort of making a late run into the box to finish it off.
Yeah, I wasn't being negative. I wasn't suggesting they were just smashing it and hoping for the best, but it does feel like it just seems to have happened. And I think, as you rightly say, I think it's part of this more fluid approach from Watford, and the fact that there are going to be players arriving on the edge of the box all being in the area, whereas before it was pretty sparsely populated, wasn't it, for most of the 90 minutes. So, yeah, I think it's just a little thing in the periphery that's a little offshoot of the way Watford are playing, just something I've noticed, and just generally asking more questions of the opposition. And I think, you know, the goal went in, and then 2 minutes later Watford were 2-0 up with a lovely goal from Will Hughes. When it fell, I could see him sort of manoeuvring his body so he'd get it on his left foot. We're sort of cut right behind it, in line with it, here in the Sir Elton John stand, and you kind of knew it was going to be a goal before it went in. And at that stage, Derby went from, it was very, very slow start, you know, lots of, like, as Jason said, there wasn't much pressure from either side, pretty congested in midfield, so a lot of tapping it around. But Watford went from 0 to 100, and Derby looked absolutely shell-shocked, and it had a touch of the Bristol Cities around it for a minute there, where they were sort of looking around. They didn't really know what was happening. They'd gone from being relatively comfortable, you know, I think we've mentioned Ismaila Sarr and Kiko were making inroads on the right. I thought Semmer struggled to get into the game on the left, but they looked absolutely shell-shocked. They didn't know quite what happened, and I felt at that stage, it's still very, very early in the game, and perhaps getting greedy after, you know, the week we've had. John, you said it was 7 days. It's 6 days, isn't it? Because it was Saturday last week that we won. So three wins in 6 days is pretty good. And I felt, almost chastised myself mentally for being greedy and saying, right, we need another one here. But it did feel like we had an opportunity. Derby were on the ropes. And I was hoping that we could deliver the knockout blow early in the first half. And it didn't quite come to pass. And I actually think Watford were lucky to go in level, if I'm honest. I think the goal that was disallowed, I haven't seen the replay, I think the goal that was disallowed was very, very soft, wherever the foul was there. I think, you know, we say, well, they always get given, but they shouldn't, I don't think. I didn't really see a clear foul. And then right on the stroke of half-time, I think it was Waghorn was in a ball over the top. We saw that. Watford succeed with that a couple of times in the second half, but he was in and he lifted his opportunity over the bar, and it could have very easily been 2-0. There was a succession of vicious in-swinging corners as well from over here on the right, and which were to give us a bit of a foreshadowing of what was going to happen later on in the game. And it had a little bit of feeling of that Everton, horrible, horrible Everton game last season in the Premier League, where Watford were 2-0 up and seemingly coasting, and then went in at half-time level on the back of some expertly delivered set pieces. So having gone from 0 to 100 in the middle of the half, I think then they sort of lost their way a little bit, and might be a bit overcritical, but genuinely think it could have been 2-2 at half time.
Yeah, you wanted them to sort of, have a go just to really kill the game off, and it didn't come. And again, I have this nagging feeling of, yes, we say, as you correct me, Michael, 3 games in 6 days, and we've got another one and another 2 in the next week. And I suppose that's the thing where you wonder where the squad management is coming into all this, where we made one change in the last 2 games. They've both been central defence. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see where he goes next.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
From the Rookery End, a podcast about life following Watford FC.
But let's look at these players. There's 14 of them made it onto the pitch. A few fewer this week than there have been in the past. You know, I'd love a Venn diagram. I'd love to sort of categorise things. I want you to picture a Venn diagram. 2 circles, lapped over slightly. One circle is going to be Friday Night Lights. Oh, yeah, the Friday Night Lights, which we all miss and we want to go and see. It's great. It's brilliant. That's our Friday Night Lights category. On the other side, it's Friday Night Cripes and people who didn't have a good Friday night. And in the middle, of course, Friday night's all right. You know, it was all right. Where are we going to put some of these players? I think it's an easy one, this. We've been singing his praise for, well, we've been hoping for him. We've been annoyed at how he's been used. And for the last 3 games, he's been doing his thing. Friday Night Lights, it's easy. Will Hughes. Mike, he can't go wrong, can he, at the moment?
No, looking really good, looking really strong, going from strength to strength, and yeah, one of, if not the most important player on the pitch for Watford. He makes things happen. He's the sort of I don't know how to describe it. He's the fulcrum is the wrong word, but everything hinges on Will Hughes and what he's able to do. He sort of marshals it in front of the back, and then he gets us ticking up top as well. It's that transition that we struggled to have at all this season, and with Will Hughes in the centre there, it seems to happen. I think he was hampered ever so slightly by what I thought was an incredibly harsh yellow card after, I think it was about 20-25 minutes, was it? Very, very early. And I thought the ref made a potential rod for his back there in booking Will Hughes. And whether that tempered him slightly, I'm not sure. But I think he was withdrawn later on to protect him. You know, as we know, he's had a long journey back from a variety of injuries and issues. So I think getting him off and getting some rest ahead of the next big game is vital, because as you rightly say, John, yeah, he's first in there as one of our Friday night lights.
Kiko and Zaha, we already mentioned, Jason, the two of them down the wing, causing trouble, being our main threat. There's no way you could take either one of those down, could you?
No, I don't think so. I think we saw their, let's not beat about the bush, we saw their Premier League quality again today. You know what I say, John, at this level, they're either quick or they're talented. These guys have got both. And the goal just summed it up. It was a spot-on pass from Kiko through for Ismaila for that first goal. And just the pace from Ismaila was unbelievable. There's no way he was favourite to get that. But he got there quick enough to keep the ball in and then get the ball pulled back. We know as well their defensive qualities, certainly at this level, absolutely fine. Saar in particular doesn't look like the frustrated figure that he did earlier in the season. All of a sudden, he's playing occasionally with a smile on his face. Mm-hmm. It's rare, but every so often. But then we are seeing him putting in a defensive shift when he needs to as well. With that, and that's important in his 4-3-3 formation. So, yeah, absolutely no doubt with these two that they are, once again, Friday lights.
Yeah, and then the one I was thinking about, Mike, again, not 100% sure, Pedro. I mean, he's in that position on his own up front, still young, as we keep saying. What do you think? Can we put him in the Friday Night Lights? Think tonight was the night?
I think so. I think he deserves it just from his sheer work rate. You know, he's playing effectively centre-forward, isn't he? And he's said it before, you know, relatively small, diminutive figure. But by crikey, he's tough. He's quick-footed. He's skillful. Strong, finds works little pockets of space for himself, not afraid to take a shot, not afraid to pick a pass when that's appropriate. He's hugely important for Watford, and I think he was unlucky. He got the ball in the penalty area and set himself for a right foot curl, and I thought this is his moment. It's going to crown his performances over the last week, really, where he's ploughed a furrow and worked really hard without much reward. Obviously, he got on the score sheet tonight, but I thought he was going to crown it with a nice curler into the top right-hand corner. It went into the top right-hand corner of the rookery, unfortunately. But I think the work that lad puts in, for me, I think absolutely he has to be Friday Night Lights. He is, you know, we've mentioned those guys, Will Hughes, Ismail Assar, Kiko, João Pedro, going to be hugely important for us in the running as we try and ask more questions of these championship defenders, and he does that for every time he's on the pitch. I think he's absolutely brilliant, and there's no question in my mind that he's among our Friday Night Lights tonight.
Okay, let's see who else can join them then. Will anyone be a Cripes? Well, let's see if we think anyone deems to be maybe had a Friday Night Cripes. Not saying they're terrible, but maybe tonight wasn't their night. At the back, Jason, in the centre, Trusticon, Cathcart. Yeah, Cathcart did what we've you know known him to do. Not much problem. Just an all right night.
Yeah, I think obviously towards the end it was a bit more like Panic at the Friday Night Disco, wasn't it? I don't know about you guys, but I was certainly panicking at the end there. There were a couple of moments that you just think, put your foot through it, man. What's Cathcart's little skied effort.
Yeah, for another corner.
In injury time for another corner where we hadn't looked comfortable all evening. And it probably has to be said, we struggled to dominate really defensively those corners. Part of that, is that down to the centre-backs? Is it down to the others? Whose responsibility is it to attack the ball and get it clear? There's part of me thinking, if Sierra Alta was on the pitch, would we have struggled as much with the corners, knowing how dominant he is aerially?
Brilliant deliveries though, Jace, it has to be said.
They were brilliant.
Burn,
yeah.
I think, wrapping his foot right round it, starting them on the sort of six, well, in 3 yards out, and then they were curling in wickedly right underneath the crossbar. So asking some pretty serious questions every time they came in fairness. I thought the delivery from their corners was terrific throughout. And you know, you do, having played in inverted commas on this very pitch in goal, and sort of with pros that haven't played for 10-15 years, and knowing how quickly and the ball comes in, and with the way you've got big six footers attacking you as well, it is very, very difficult to deal with a good ball in like that. So I have sympathy for them, but yeah, interesting to hear you sort of sound not entirely convinced with the way they dealt with them, despite them being such good set pieces.
They still need to be dealt with, and good players will deal with them, I think. But yeah, you're right, the quality of the balls in were fantastic and shows what you can do with excellent balls in from set pieces. And I thought early on, I sort of started at the end, going back to the beginning, I mentioned about the centre-backs not being put under much pressure at 0-0 meant it was sort of the distribution from these guys had to be good. They had to try and find a man. It wasn't always made easy for them because their usual outs were being quite closely marked. So Hughes was covered. The fullbacks were covered. Just sort of made their job a little bit more difficult to try and start a Watford attack. Didn't always sort of manage with great success. Not disastrously so. I don't think we can sort of put them on a pedestal, and I don't think we put them in the Cripes. But they did have me worried every now and again. We have to be fair and say, other than their own goal, it could have been another clean sheet. Until Patrick Roberts went off, I didn't think Derby looked threatening at all, because whenever the ball seemed to end up with him, and then he'd sort of make a bad pass or an error of judgment, and they sort of, things started to break down. It was only when they really started to press in the second half, and then they took Patrick Roberts off, and then they really started to look threatening. That's when Derby started causing us trouble.
I think Craig Cathcart and Troost-Ekong are comfortably in the Friday night's all right category for the reasons Jason described. The one thing I would suggest is that perhaps Troost-Ekong's delivery, I think he really struggles to get the ball moving out there. His passing, I just think he struggles with it. And I wonder whether that was impacted by the lack of Sir Alta, you know, that domineering centre-back partner who you have every confidence in to, you know, clears everything up, doesn't he? Craig Cathcart described him a bit unkindly earlier as meat and potatoes, but he's just Craig Cathcart, isn't he? If you say Craig Cathcart, you know exactly what you're going to get: a solid block tackle, a 6-foot pass to someone in space, or he's just going to put it out cool and calmly for an opposition throw-in. That's what Craig Cathcart's going to do, and that's absolutely fine. But I think Sir Alta's has more to his game than that, and whether that not exposed Troost-Ekong, but just asked more questions of him. And I think in terms of his distribution, I think there are question marks over that, definitely. Both of them comfortably in the Friday night's all right category.
Yeah, interesting, because I saw some people say after the Preston game, was Sir Alta not quite as 100% because he wasn't with Troost-Ekong? Yeah. And I think maybe that's the thing, you know, that partnerships and those, you know, the fact that it is a partnership can add much more to a centre-back pairing, not just the fact that they're two good footballers. Jason, Messina, he's got to be all right. And I suppose Barkman, in some ways, he almost made himself a Friday Night Lights and into the top category for a very quick save on a corner that was heading into the top left corner.
Yeah, he did well there. I did wonder, sort of, as we saw these set pieces coming in from Derby. I know they on the telly they're talking about Shay Given works with their set pieces because he knows what the goalies don't like. And I did wonder if they've tried a few of these whippy ones because we didn't seem to be putting anyone on the near post. So he did very well to get across and keep that one out. And we could see from his face, from the wow that he mouthed. Wow. He sat there as the ball was cleared, that it was a close one. And that was a good save. Probably got away with one with the goal that was disallowed in the first half, where he sort of ran into Andre Wisdom's arse and got the free kick for it.
There was a sort of precursor to that when one of those great balls came in. And he did get a punch on it, but it spun off the top of his knuckles and then over the crossbar for a corner. And that was a little bit, you thought, okay, because I was talking to Adam before the game, and you know he's got that terrific record of 6 clean sheets in 9 games now. But how much has really been asked of him? He hasn't had to make any sort of really amazing saves, hasn't he? But he's looked competent and he's looked solid, and he's looked that if any questions are asked of him, he's going to deal with them. And that was the first time that I think tonight he had a sort of a bit more of a hairy evening, didn't he? There was more questions asked of him more frequently with a back two who hadn't played together very recently in front of him. And I think that was a little precursor to it being a slightly, not wobbly, but sort of nervy night, perhaps. It was, it was a tough night for him. But I think in the main, he dealt with everything pretty comfortably, didn't he?
Jace, the middle two, you know, we've seen Will's praise, but in theory they've got better. Maybe it's better because, you know, they're playing better positions, and Will's doing that work at the back of the three. Chalobah was getting big props from the Sky Sports coverage. Cleverly was working his little socks off, as he always has done, but he certainly seems to have done since he's been given that captain's armband. Nothing shone, I don't think, for me, from them to make them Friday Night Light. So they've got to be Friday Night All Right.
Yeah, I think so. I think I mentioned earlier about the fact that the midfield was quite congested, so hard for them to shine in a congested midfield. But what they did do well, as I said, they were looking for space out wide, supporting the wide men. I thought, again, it's the way we set up just suits them both. Having that extra protection in Hughes behind them, it means Cleverly can run about like the engineers all over the pitch. Chalobah isn't trying to spray passes around. He's got men around him that he can play simple passes to, which suits him better, just to sort of turn and tick things over, play a pass, try and find some more space, just progress up the pitch and get into the box and support when those balls come in. So, yeah, sort of decent from those guys again tonight.
I thought Chalobah was really competent tonight. I think he looked organised, he looked on it, he looked focused, which is sometimes a criticism I have. I think he drifts in and out of games and can find himself having to make late challenges or whatever. He finds himself in a pickle, and I thought tonight he looked much more consummate. I thought he did well tonight. It was one of the better performances of the season from Chalobah, I thought tonight. I thought he was really good.
Yeah, he's definitely been growing a lot, I think, to be more consistent.
Yeah, that's what we need from him.
That consistent three that he's been playing with, or the two he's been playing with. Mike, we haven't got anybody in the Friday night cripes. I know we won. I know we really shouldn't have anybody there. But Ken Semmer did an absolutely atrocious move on the left-hand side in the first half. And I think, you know, it was, I don't know what he was doing, but he was trying to do some step-over thing, and it didn't work. If I could find anybody for that reason, maybe we could put him there. And he was a bit quiet as well.
Yeah, I think definitely that moment was a Friday night cripes, Friday night yikes, whichever one you want to go with. And I think Ken's right foot deserves to go Friday night yikes, because, I mean, let's be honest, he hasn't got one, has he? He has to run round it to get onto his left foot. So that's always a cause of vague amusement for me. So, that moment over on the far side in front of, with Graham Taylor watching on there, that brilliant banner there. He made a bit of a mess of things, didn't he? So that was not his proudest moment. And I think overall, you know, as we touched on earlier, he didn't quite get in the game as we've seen him. We've grown so accustomed, certainly here in front of the Sir Elton John stand, him beating his man and getting to the byline and getting a decent ball in. He, you know, for most of the season, he's been the only one really doing that. But I don't think he quite hit the heights tonight. That moment, Friday night yikes, Friday night cripes. But I think it would be harsh of King Ken on King Ken to put him in there in that category. But certainly he'll be looking to improve. I can only hope it's not my midweek prank that's still playing on his mind.
Oh, well, you might have ruined him mentally, Mike, and that's it. That's the whole season gone. Substitutes are always hard to really put any high unless they come on and they score the winning goal. But Gosling, Jace, just he's doing more of what we have seen him do. And I'm growing more confident in if, you know, the midfield three, either to get injured or to get an extra yellow card. You know, he's there, he's ready to go.
Yeah, he's the man to come on again, I think, isn't he, if we do need to disrupt that three. There was a moment, I think, when he first came on, his touch was looking a bit wobbly. I'm not sure if that's because someone pinged a ball into him too fast. I don't want to say he wasn't expecting the ball, because as a footballer you should always be expecting the ball. Yeah, he didn't quite manage to control it, sort of pinged off him, caught him a bit by surprise. But other than that, again, it was a solid performance, making the tackles when he needs to make the tackles, just working hard as part of that midfield three. Nothing silly, nothing too extravagant, just recycling the ball, almost sort of a like for like when he came on for Chalobah, just doing what Chalobah was doing to the same effect.
Zinchenko, Michael, again, you know, not so, again, didn't do anything spectacular, but just growing a little bit, or every game, every appearance he's making, he's growing that little bit more.
Yeah, I felt sorry for him because he came on at exactly the wrong moment, didn't he? Him and the double substitution happened, and Derby really came into the game, didn't it? It was hearts and mouths really for the last 15 minutes or so, and the game sort of ratcheted up in not just intention but in speed and intensity on the pitch. So I think it's always difficult for a substitute to hit those that hit the ground running at that sort of speed with the game at that point. So I felt sorry for him again. I think, you know, he showed what we know that he has, which is a lovely touch, a willingness to drive forward. He was another one who had a shot on goal late on, I think just about the edge of the box. I thought, oh, this is perfect. He's just dropped for him, and you could just hear it, the connection with the boot. He just thinned it. If you've played golf, you know what I mean. He just didn't catch it right, and it didn't really threaten the keeper. But he showed what he's capable of. Found it difficult, I think, because anyone would find it difficult coming on in the game in that situation. It changed virtually straight away when he came on. But I think you can see what he can bring to the side. There was no space for him down this left-hand side at all. It was frantic. He was having to do a lot of defending, get back, get forward. So tough for him, but he did what he had to. And I think we've seen more glimpses of Of what's available there. And I think, you know, if Ken Semmer is having a rough trot, then perhaps, you know, starting Zinchenogo out on the left, it's not his preferred position, of course, but I think he could definitely do a job there. Just, I'd like to see him out there with a bit more space when things aren't quite so frenetic, and I think it might suit him.
And of course, final one, Jason, the young Mr. Wilmot did come on again. Very 14 minutes to go, I suppose it was. Came into that midfield role, fine.
Yeah, it's okay. Obviously, as you say, unfortunate timing in that they scored seconds after he's come on, and he replaced the excellent Will Hughes, and he's not Will Hughes. You'll see the passing is not the same, and I think there were a few that went astray. Having said that, I think at the end he did ping a lovely ball out to Ismail Assar to relieve the pressure down the right-hand side, where it ended up with, I think, Kiko and Saar pinging a ball between themselves and sort of wasting a couple of minutes. Give him credit for that one. It's tough when you're coming on with, 10, 15 minutes to spare, and you're all of a sudden up against it. You're protecting a one-goal lead at home. Everyone, the opposition are throwing the kitchen sink at you. It's tough. You've got to dig in, and you've got to defend. And he was part of that defence. There wasn't much else he could really do. It was just the opportunities to get out and try and relieve a bit of pressure. He perhaps didn't do as much as you would have liked, but that one at the end probably keeps him in the Friday night all right section.
Yeah. So it was more than an all right game. You've got to say that because it was a win, of course, the third one in 6 days. But the Hornets go on to two away matches at Blackburn and Bournemouth.
Part of the Athletic Podcast Network. This is From the Rookery End.
Remember, if you haven't yet, you can subscribe to The Athletic. It costs you, it's quite a good deal at the moment, but if you do subscribe, not only do you get the analysis and coverage that The Athletic get to offer, but you also get to hear these podcasts absolutely ad-free, not a one, if you listen via the app and The Athletic website. Currently, the offer at the moment is £29.99. That's half price at the moment, which works out at less than a pound a week, but actually about 8p a day. So you want to go to theathletic.com/rookeryend. That's theathletic.com/rookeryend. Subscribers, you will be able to take part on the 8th of March. The quiz that Adam is going to be hosting to find who is the cleverest and most knowledgeable of all the Athletic subscribers. And the Watford quiz, which Adam is hosting, is on the 8th of March. But you have to be a subscriber to take part.
Raising money for prostate cancer as well, of course, a charity close to our heart. So if you can get involved in that, please do.
Now, family is very important to Watford. We are the original family club. What family members do you remember playing for Watford, Jason? Like
the Holdsworth twins, of course.
Oh, of course, yes, yes.
Yeah, we've got those guys. Who else we got? We have got... Did Kenny Jackett's dad play for Watford or not? Have I just made that up?
Exactly. This is one of those things. And there's been some fantastic news recently of a new signing for Watford in the youth system that has a very long family legacy of being part of the Watford family. Another member of the Skinny Williams family has signed a contract to be part of the Watford Academy. And I caught up with Ollie Wicken to find out more about this family tradition that started with Skinny Williams. Plus, other ones, including the Holdsworths. And I started by asking Ollie, who was Skilly Williams?
Skilly Williams is a legendary goalkeeper from Watford's distant past. So he was playing 100 years ago. He made his debut for Watford in 1913, just before the First World War. And he ended with Watford in 1926. So his career lasted 13 years, because he did play during the war as well as going off to fight. And he made lots of appearances. He's famous for his flat cap that he would wear. He was the start of what has turned out to be a little bit of a dynasty in Watford's history.
Yeah, because you look back at that, didn't you, in a article for the Watford Treasury. It's been a long dynasty, but they've still got a big connection back to old Skilly.
They have indeed. So his son, called Reg, Skilly was also called Reg, but we know him as Skilly. His son, Reg, played for Watford during the war. Reg was born the 28th of January 1922, and I'll come back to that date in a moment. On the 28th of January, he was born while Skilly was playing at Spurs in an FA Cup match. And Reg played for Watford during the war between 1940 and 1945. Went off to play for Chelsea many years. Reg had three children who didn't play for Watford, but at the next level down, which is Reg's grandsons and Skilly's great-grandsons, two players played for Watford. There was Daniel Greaves and Grant Corner. So now we're talking about players that some of your listeners will have heard of already and may have seen play. So Grant Cornock was playing reserves in the juniors late 1990s, and Daniel Greaves made a first-team appearance for Watford in the full Members' Cup at Fulham in 1998, I think it was. And things have moved on apace since then as well, because we're now going down to Jack Greaves. And Jack Greaves is the great-great-grandson of Skinny. And last week, on the 28th of January, which was his granddad Reg's 99th birthday, or would have, Jack Greaves was offered an apprenticeship by Watford. We've now got four generations of connection.
Amazing. I mean, there's families and stuff are very famous in football. You know, that sort of personal level that we have at Watford. You know, I remember looking at the first ever Watford team I ever saw play in 1986, 1987, and seeing two of the players who looked very similar. And then you look and you go, oh, they are the same surname. It was Dean and David Holdsworth. But you did an episode recently for Hornet Heaven, which you wrote, and of course, Colin Mace was the narrator and, well, every single voice that's in that episode, about the Joy Brothers. And that episode really, I love that episode. And there's the thing about Hornet Heaven I love is where you learn something historic, but actually you start really thinking about your connection with the football club. And they were three people who did actually play for Watford, but then didn't necessarily stick around for that long.
That's right. So they there were three brothers, Norman, Basil and Bertie, and they all made one appearance for Watford. They were brothers, and really the reason behind that is that in those days, this was when Watford were called West Hearts, in those days, West Hearts was a sports club, like it is now, a social club, if you like. So there was a sort of social scene going, and a lot of the players had been to Ordenham School, as these guys had. It was mates together and brothers together, and West Hearts were just feeling their way into the Southern League, certainly when Norman played. And he made his debut, debut and only game he played, which was West Hearts' second appearance in the Southern League, second game in the Southern League. There was just this time when lots and lots of people were rotating through the team because they were trying to find out who was any good and who could play at this slightly higher level.
Well, what year was it we're talking there?
1896. Wow. For Norman. So, but this was after the three great brothers, Alec, Alf and Freddie Sargent, who had been playing in the 1880s and 1890s. And they, Freddie Sargent was a terrific player. Best in the county, as the Watford Observer would have said. They all played in the same team. So if you're talking brothers there, they would be all in the same team. And there actually was one game, a friendly, where there was another sergeant in the team playing goal. We don't know what his Christian name was, and we don't know what relation he was. About to start a rumour that it might have been their dad.
Yeah, stick dad in goal. Yeah, I like that. Exactly. We're a bit short. Dad, can you play? Yeah, stick him in goal. Yeah.
Well, because we do know that this extra sergeant did referees in matches as well. So it just strikes me that it might have been an older man who went in goal and refereed matches.
Oh, excellent. Well, that's quite a lot. I mean, there's three brothers to the Joys. And even though they didn't sort of stay in the Watford family, there wasn't really a Watford family at that point at all. But they still had that connection with the club, which ended them being up in Hornet Heaven. And I'm trying to think of other families that we've had at Watford. And okay, I know the Holdsworths. Are there any other famous, well, not famous brothers, but well-known brothers or fathers and sons that have played for Watford and been part of the Watford family?
Very much so. So even in the same team that we were talking about there for Skiddy playing at Tottenham Hotspurs, we had Charlie White was a member of the team, and he had a brother called Tom White who played several times in the same team for Watford in 1909. They were the last brothers to play in a forward line together. So I'm going to do some slightly obscure statistics for you here.
Okay, they were the last,
they were the last brothers to line up together in a forward line. Watford. Then in the 1950s, there were a pair called Colin and Ernie Bateman, and they were the last brothers to play in the same starting together. The Holdsworths played in the same team together and were on the pitch at the same time together, but never started together.
That's, you know what, that's one of those things that really surprises me. I know Dean didn't stay around Watford as long as David, but I just imagine them being on the pitch more. Maybe, I don't know, maybe that, again, that photograph I saw of the first team, Watford's, you know, team picture I ever saw as a child. But I just imagine them playing together just so much more. But they so did they ever start a game together?
No, they never did, because Dean largely was a substitute. But they were on the pitch together a lot. So that was the statistic, that they never started together. And then there's Tommy Smith and Jack Smith.
Yes, of course.
They took part in the same match, but they weren't on the field at the same time as each other. So against Brighton in April 2003, just before Tommy left, and just as Jack was starting, Tommy was substituted off, and then a few minutes later, Jack was substituted on. Then we also had Ashley Young and his younger brother, Lewis Young.
Yes, of course,
Lewis's appearance was after Ashley had gone.
Definitely, yeah.
So they never played together. They also had another brother, Kyle, who was part of the academy, but I don't think he went to professional. If we go back to Kenny Jackett in the 1980s, his dad played for Watford between 1949 and 1953, and Kenny had an older brother called Alan, or still does, Alan Jackett, but he wasn't at Watford. He was at another local club whose name shall never be spoken.
Okay, we shall move on very quickly.
There was, even in the 1950s, Watford had a manager called Eddie Hapgood, and then he was sacked in 1950, and 3 years later, his son turned up at Watford.
These are things that you sort of beautifully touch on in Hornet Heaven. And so you're on series 14. We played a clip a few weeks ago from the first episode, but it's four episodes in this series. Episode two was The Joys of Watford. Episode three really made me laugh. Of all the characters that Colin has played on Hornet Heaven, the historic characters of Henry Grover or Bill Mainwood, but this one, he played a dog called Wooter. And I do like the idea. What's the rule then? So if I ever get a dog and I want him to come to Hornet Heaven with me, I have to name him after a footballer. Is that right?
That's exactly how it works, yes.
My next dog will be called Nyron then. Okay, perfect. And the most recent one, tell us about that one then.
Listeners will be familiar with the 13-year-old program assistant called Derek Garston, who was born in 1908 and died in 1921. He's one of the fictitious characters. But when I was writing one of the early episodes, I decided he'd died in 1921. So that means his centenary in Hornet Heaven, 100 years as a 13-year-old, is this year. The story is about some celebrations that are planned to celebrate his centenary.
Ollie is part of the Watford Treasury team. You can go to the watfordtreasury.co.uk to find out more about the historical document magazine that they put out, as well as the other fantastic fanzine, YBR, Yellow, Black or Red, which is out on a monthly basis at the moment. Ollie was talking about the 100th anniversary of the Hornet Heaven young programme assistant, Derek Garston. He's been a 13-year-old boy for his entire Watford afterlife, almost 100 years now. And the upcoming centenary has made him a bit touchy about the fact that he'll never grow up for the rest of eternity. In the scene set in December 2020, Henry Grover, the founder of the club, goes to see Derek in the programme office. Henry breezes in, totally oblivious to what's bothering Derek.
Ah, there you are, Derek. I know Bill said I shouldn't be asking you at the moment, but I need some of your famous facts. You are, after all, the fount of all Watford Football Club knowledge in Hornet Heaven. Crikey! Thank you for such kind words, Mr. Crover, sir. Not at all, Derek. In fact, over the 70 years that I've been up here, I've come to regard you as a sort of son. That's lovely, Mr. Grover, sir. I'm flattered, sir. Of course, I say a son, but I suppose I mean a grandson. or even a great-grandson, because you're so young, and quite a weird great-grandson at that, come to think of it, because you never grow up. Great. We're back on this, are we, Mr. Grover, sir? Anyway, the reason I'm here is that I'm interested in whether our head coach, Vladimir Ivich, is marshalling the correct blend of youth and experience in his promotion-seeking side. Please, could you tell me how many of the players that played against Cardiff yesterday were, say, 21 or under? The answer's 5, Mr. Grover, sir. James Garner, João Pedro, Jeremy Ngakia, Ben Wilmot, and Domingos Quina. In order of the recency of their birth, Mr. Grover, sir. But do we have to talk about age, sir? I wonder if that's too many youngsters for a successful team. You see, I'm worried that... In fact, I'd value your opinion on something, young fellow me lad. Would you mind accompanying me to an old game from the 1980s? I've only got a programme for myself at the moment, but I'm sure you could duck under the turnstile. Mr. Grover, sir, these continual reminders that I'm a child, I could probably find you a sherbet dib-dab, young man, or something like that, if you're a good boy. I'll get myself a programme, Mr. Grover, sir.
A Watford FC podcast brought to you by The Athletic. This is From the Rookery End.
So we've got how many days? What day is it? Friday? 1, 2, 3. Yeah, anyway, in a few days' time, Watford will be playing away at Blackburn. Mike, the one thing we didn't see tonight, which I sort of was hoping for, was we seem to be getting a little dependent on this 4-3-3 and these 11 or these 10-11 starting players that have been consistent. And that, I think that's very, very important. And I like the fact that he's not rotating players at the start of a game. I do prefer a manager that starts a consistent team but makes those substitutions when players start losing their legs, just to have that sort of consistency. We didn't see many substitutes today. And we have got more games coming up. And, you know, that Parica, I wanted not necessarily him to start the game, but I wanted him to get some more minutes in there.
John, I know exactly what you mean. It feels like he sort of had a bit of a stop-start beginning to his Watford career, doesn't it? And it feels like he almost deserves to have some minutes. But my take on it is really very simple. At this stage of the season, with feeling like Watford are rounding a bend, turning a corner a little bit, if it ain't broke... Don't fix it. But I don't mean that.
Yeah, I absolutely get that. But with the number of substitutes that we can make.
Yeah, still, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. The players that we're talking about, and I'll give you an example why. We've talked about done our Venn diagram tonight. How many of them were in the Friday night cripes circle?
Yeah.
Ken Semmer's right foot, and that's it, and at a push. So, you know, this is a team who has won 3 games in a very, very difficult competitive division in 6 days, scored 9 goals in the process and conceded 1. So what this team absolutely has to do is build on performances, but most importantly of all, and I think this is going to be the key to the rest of this season, is confidence. Because we were bereft of confidence before Bristol City. You know, the Coventry game was a real low point. It was an away point, so it shouldn't have been, but it felt like we were on the floor. And there was no confidence, there was no joie de vivre, they weren't enjoying their football. And that seems to have changed. Now, I still think that's fragile. I still think there's little cases of, you know, it's easy to lapse back into, I think, are we going to have pre and post Bristol City? Is that how we're going to see the season? But that's still easy for a group of players to go back to into that sort of comfort zone of feeling a bit sorry for yourself or it not falling for you or not going well. And this group need to move together as a group. And I really want to see them getting as many minutes together as possible, because what they're doing, as I said it earlier, is asking questions of the opposition. And if they can do that, we've got players who can ask questions that opposition won't be able to answer. Jason's talked about it, pace and skill. Ismail Assar and Kiko down the right, Ken when he's on form on the left, Zinchenko to come in if he's not, João Pedro beavering away in the middle there, Will Hughes, Tom Cleverley, Chalabar. Different types of player, all very difficult to play against and all integral. This is a great, great side. The frustrating thing is it's taken a little while for us to see it. Now we've got it and now they're motoring a little bit. Let's stick with them, I think. And yes, they have to rotate to a degree. But Ismail Assar has played virtually every game, 90 minutes almost of every single game. So I think we stick with it and we stay on the front foot. You know, he's made substitutions late on, so people aren't having a rest. The sort of timetable is weird, but it does build in extra days for rest. You know, we can have the Watford boys can have their feet up in front of Soccer Saturday, whatever it's called these days, tomorrow, while watching the others scrap it out. So we've got a little bit of extra rest. So it's about how they manage that. They need to train cleverly. they all need to train, not just you, Thomas. But so they need to be...
I get what you're saying, Mike. I absolutely get what you're saying, but I think there's an element of knowing that injuries do happen and players need to be ready, and that's part of it. And the whole thing of, you know, maybe the one reason why there have been no changes the last three games is they've had no time to work on anything new. It was...
No
game
need,
after
John.
Game after game after game. Yeah, I know no what you're need. Saying, but it's nagging at the back of my mind. Why am I the one worrying? That's your job. You know, and I suppose I didn't necessarily want to see him. Basically, if Pedro is the one in the middle, who can replace him? Andre Gray or Stipe Perica at the moment. So there's a limit, and you just want a few more minutes in them for not to unbalance things, which we did talk about the fact that when you make some substitutes and you unbalance things and all of a sudden the other team score. It's a nagging thing in the back of my mind. Maybe I'm wrong, but it's just I know what you're saying, but I know the little voice in the back of my mind. I know what he's saying. Jason, would you put more emphasis on the Blackburn game or more emphasis on the Bournemouth game if you were Cisco?
Oh, blimey, take it one game at a time, Brian. I don't like this. We need to take one more seriously than the other. They are both 3 points. Okay, yeah, if we lose the Bournemouth one, it means they pick up 3 points there and they're in the promotion race. But ahead of the game, I want 3 points from Blackburn. And then whatever happens in the Blackburn game, I want 3 points from the Bournemouth game. So I wouldn't be presumptuous enough to be looking forward to the Bournemouth game when the Blackburn game hasn't been played yet. So I would treat the Blackburn game seriously, look at the state of the players before the game. If the starting 11 from tonight is fit enough, okay, do what you want to do with the centre-backs, perhaps bring Sierra back in. But if they're fit to play, then you start with the same 11.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I bet you better be right about this, lads. Thank you very much for listening to From the Rookend. Thank you very much to Ollie for his input. And thank you, Michael, for sticking around at Vicarage Road and with your contributions.
Yeah, always a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
And thank you very much, Jason.
Thank you.
You can follow us on Twitter. That's our big one. On Instagram and on Facebook. Just look for @WatfordPodcast. And we'll be back, of course, after that Blackburn game in midweek.
Come on, you horn!
The Athletic.